good morning. This is Per Fagring, KBOO News and Public Affairs. And we are going to be talking about empire and its discontents and its limits. You know, it's sort of been said that the U.S. empire is not like the old Roman and British empires where they actually had colonies and, you know, ruled directly from the center. But, well, it's sort of true in a way. You know, we've had John Perkins on KBOO a few times, who's author of The Economic Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And he told how his job when he was in that trade was kind of hoisting huge loans on third world rulers. And the idea was to get these countries in debt so that they would do Washington's bidding. And if the rulers didn't go for the loan, from which they would get rich themselves, and in came the killers and the people who had arranged for a regime change, as they call it, and things like that. So you have that aspect of the U.S. empire. Also, you have this is actually in the Oregonian the other day. It was a one of those the question and answer thing on page 2, asking about how many nations the U.S. has a military presence in. And the answer is the U.S. has a military presence at 702 installations in 146 countries. And actually, that's a huge number. The UN only has, they have 191 members, so that's about the number of nations in the world, and the U.S. has a military presence in 146 of them. So anyway, that sort of shows you what the U.S. empire is about. Why is the U.S. Why does the U.S. have an empire? Why is it doing this kind of stuff? Well, we'll go back to George F. Kennan, who was a very influential State Department guy in the 40s and 50s. So regarded as a hero by a lot of liberals and centrists. And anyway, he wrote a document for President Truman in 1948. Presidential Policy Statement Number 23, and it said, this is a quote from George F. Kennan, "The U.S. has 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which permits us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better." And that is by George F. Kennan, who is sort of regarded as the father, maybe the godfather of the realist school of American statecraft back in 1948. And things have certainly gotten no better. They've gotten worse since then. Here is a statement by Henry Kissinger, who is sort of regarded as one of the realists. So actually, you know, it's interesting. Henry Kissinger, we really revile him now because we know what horrible crimes he has been part of. But back in the 60s, during when Nixon was president, a lot of the Washington media people sort of thought of Henry Kissinger as the only rational guy in Washington, you know, that Nixon was sort of nuts, and Kissinger was kind of keeping him from doing terrible things. So Henry Kissinger got a lot of a lot of undeserved praise from people in Washington. This is Henry Kissinger And this is from the January-February 2003 edition of Eagles Newsletter. I'm not sure what that is. I wonder if that's Phyllis Schlafly's group, the Eagle Forum. Anyway, this is what Henry Kissinger said. Think of this when we hear talk about supporting our troops in Iraq. Henry Kissinger said, quote, "Military men are dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns for foreign policy." So that is how people like Kissinger regard our young men and women who are fighting in Iraq and elsewhere. Well, a lot of people seem to think that the U.S., well, they thought the same about Britain, too, that these are sort of good empires, that they actually gave back to the countries that they ruled. You know, Tony Blair is always talking in very idealistic language about the obligations that, we have to the world's poor. But I think this is really kind of not true at all. It's a misstatement. There are no good empires. There are bad empires, and there are worse empires. Why are they bad? Because they all take resources from the colonies, whether they do this in a brutal way or a businesslike way or whatever. They take resources from the colonies, and they also, by kind of running these colonies, they block the colonies from their own path of development. I mean, every nation in the world, they have their needs, and they have their ways of doing things, and over time they get better at it. They develop, and when one nation is kind of wiped out by another, that path of development is blocked. Or it goes into all kinds of back channels, and you can see that when the Europeans first landed on this continent, they over a period of a few hundred years, they wiped out the Indian culture, almost wiped out the Indians, and they prevented. The Indians had really kind of a pretty thriving civilization, not just in South America and Central America with the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Incas, but in North America. They had nations, they had treaties with each other, they did all kinds of things, but this was just kind of obliterated, this European pattern. They were chased off their land. They were pushed further and further west. They were actually decimated by disease and killing. And so the Indians never really, they lost a chance to develop on their own. I think in lots of the new, so-called New World, they're coming back. We see they have elected a president in Bolivia. They are kind of on the march in other countries in South America. They make up a great deal of the Zapatista movement in Mexico. So, we can hope that they are on the way back as the empire wanes and loses power. I think that in this century, the Indians of the Western Hemisphere will kind of come back. How does the empire take away from the colonies? Well, in Perkins' book, he describes how these loans saddle these countries with all sorts of conditions. They have to be refinanced all the time, and the World Bank comes in and tells them, well, yeah, we'll refinance your loan, but you have to do this. You have to kind of start charging for public schools. You have to cut out health services. You got to do all sorts of things. You just exist to pay back the loan. It got so bad that Argentina, with the help of Venezuela, paid back its World Bank loan just to get the World Bank off their backs. This is from a newspaper in Nigeria, the Daily Trust of Abuja, where Headline is, Third World Loses $200 Billion Through Capital Flight. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said that. In 2002, for the sixth consecutive year, developing countries made a net transfer of financial resources of almost $200 billion to other countries, the United States Secretary General Kofi Annan has said. Funds should be moving from developed countries to developing countries, but these numbers tell us the opposite is happening. Funds that could be promoting investment and growth in developing countries or building schools and hospitals are instead being transferred abroad. So that, in a nutshell, is kind of what the empire does. It sucks out wealth from the colonies and uses it at home. This was true of the Roman Empire. It was true of the British Empire. And it is true of the U.S. corporate empire. Well, our empire began basically with the conquest of the so-called New World. And you could think of this as the biggest free lunch in history. Starting around 500 years ago, the European powers had access to fertile land, only what looked like unlimited minerals, and slave labor. That's free labor. Free labor. They had, that's when, and they all began around in the early 1500s. And you could argue that the guilt over slavery is what led to racism. That before 1500, there were lots of animosities between people in the ancient and medieval worlds, but you didn't have the kind of racism we have now. And so some people think that it began with slavery, that because people in Europe felt this guilt over having these slaves, that they had to explain it away somehow. And so that's when this idea that, black people from Africa were really not good for much else except just to work on the plantations. The wealth from the empire is what jump-started capitalism. So you have these three things all began at one time. The empire, slavery, and capitalism, and they've been sort of inextricably entwined ever since. The Europeans they broke into nature's treasury, as it were, like they got the keys to the bank vault, and they just thought that all this wealth was unlimited, it would never end. So capitalism seemed like a reasonable way to... There's no use fighting over. You can just go in and grab what you can and work hard, and you too can be rich. And it allowed the West to rule the world for a few centuries. But now the resources are running out, and we see an end to growth and an end to the empire. There are some observers think that the empire is already starting on its way down, started back in 1970. And so there's a sort of a sense among the imperialists of a kind of a desperation. You see it in the war in Iraq and this what's leading up to a possible war with Iran. They're fighting for control of a sinking ship. So that's the Western civilization that we hear about a lot in the media. And that is supposed to represent us. Well, while the imperialists and their armies are fighting, maybe we should start looking for lifeboats and get off this sinking ship. One of the big battles going on right now is this whole question about Iran and its so-called plan to acquire nuclear weapons. Now, Iran claims that they are just going for peaceful nuclear energy for civilian purposes. And the U.S., the Washington warlords say, ha ha, you have so much oil, you don't need to do that. Well, that's not true. Iran doesn't have that much oil, and it will run out someday. And actually, even if they do have oil, while they have it, if they can power their own economy with nuclear power to some degree, then that is more oil to sell on the market, which is going to be booming until it just kind of runs out or until the civilized world finds alternative sources of energy. There are some observers who say that Iran will not have a nuclear bomb for 6 to 10 or more years. This is an article in the L.A. Times on January 19th by a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Shireen Ebadi, and engineering professor, Mohammad Sahimi. And they said that Iran is nowhere close to having a nuclear bomb, even if they want one. So what is the rush? Why is the U.S. going gung-ho to report Iran to the Security Council, and who knows what happens? And there's all kinds of talk of going to war with Iran, bombing their nuclear installation. Well, the reason for the rush is that on March 20, Iran is planning to sell its oil for euros. They're going to create what they call an oil bourse. A bourse is a return for market, the stock market. And in this, the oil bourse is set to start on March 20, which I think is a new year in Iran. And oil will be sold for euros. What this means is that countries that buy oil will not have to hang on to their dollars. Right now, oil is sold only for dollars. That's one of the deals we have made with Saudi Arabia and OPEC. And a lot of people think that the reason the U.S. went to war with Saddam Hussein is because he started selling oil for euros. Well, if you can buy oil for euros, there's no need to hang on to dollars. Right now, every year, America runs up a huge debt and trade deficit. China, Japan, and other investors have billions of dollars. And they're squirreled away, you know, to use to buy oil. And this is what keeps the value of the dollar where it is. It allows these countries are actually financing our consumerism. Well, if they don't need the dollars and they start dumping them, which sort of has been happening a little bit already, then the value of the dollar is going to really fall. You're going to have horrible inflation in this country. The U.S. to keep dollars, to keep being able to borrow money, it will offer higher interest rates, and those interest rates will percolate through our own economy. Higher interest rates mean the sort of a collapse of the housing boom, which is sort of what's financing a lot of this consumerism right now, and so it could wreck our economy. Another thing to keep in mind is that China, you know, having such a huge bunch of dollars in their possession, if they started selling them, they could pull the plug on the dollar anytime they want to. So considering all this and considering how the effects of a war with Iran would really be horrendous, Iran can strike back in many ways. They can, you know, they have state-of-the-art missiles that can destroy shipping in the Persian Gulf. They could block the Straits of Hormuz. They could rev up the insurrection in Iraq even higher than it is now. They could strike at Israel, which they regard as one of the instigators of the war with Iraq, of Iran, rather. There are lots of things they can do. They can take their oil off the market. They can... And so they, a reasonable person would think twice or three times about making any kind of military moves on Iran. But then again, we are being ruled by a bunch of people in Washington who are not quite rational. But so that's sort of the caveat. But I will make this hopeful prediction that sometime early in March, Mohammed El-Baradei is going to report to the International Atomic Energy Agency about what the state of affairs with Iran's nuclear program are. And presumably the U.S. will use his report, or try to use his report, and Europe is involved with this too, and they will try and report Iran to the Security Council. And what happens then, who knows? I mean, Russia and China are on the Security Council. They have vetoes. Now, they are sort of putting a little pressure on Iran to kind of not be so hard-nosed against, you know, against the U.S. But when it comes right down to the crunch, it's very likely that Russia and China both, one or both, will veto any sanctions against Iran. Iran also says that disreporting them to the Security Council, and they will take measures like taking their oil off the market and other things. So my prediction is this, that sort of sometime in March, early March, before El-Baradei makes his report, Iran will accept Russia's offer to enrich uranium on Russian soil. This is sort of the big sticking point that we hear about the most, that Iran wants to enrich uranium on its own soil, which actually, under the non-proliferation treaty, they have the legal right to do. Anyway, so this is the prediction that in March, Iran will accept Russia's compromise offer, and this removes the West's pretext for punishing Iran. The rest of the world will probably heave a sigh of relief. The Washington warlords will be gnashing their teeth because right after they announce this deal with Russia, they will also go ahead with the oil bores. And what can the U.S. do? I mean, Iran has given in on the nuclear issue, and they are just doing what any country has a right to do. They sell their oil for whatever currency they choose to accept. So the U.S., this is my hopeful prediction that this will happen, early March. And so then we will have to face up the consequences with our sort of overheated, debt-ridden economy. Because right now the U.S. is sort of getting a free lunch. The U.S. Prints bad checks and calls them currency. And people, countries and businesses that take those dollars, those dollars lose value all the time. Well, how does the U.S. get out from under its debt? There's not too many ways of doing it. Plunder is one, and it seems to be what they tried in Iraq, but it's not working. We're getting less oil from Iraq than Iraq was selling back in Saddam Hussein's day. I think the likely result is that the U.S. will try to print more dollars and inflate its way out, because if dollars are worth less, the amount of the debt stays the same. So you're paying off a debt with cheaper dollars, which makes it great if you have a mortgage. But you can only do that so far. A huge inflation would come. And so if you have a big mortgage, this might sort of satisfy a lot of people who have overpriced homes out in the suburbs, and if their income can sort of keep up with inflation, they can sort of get out from under their huge mortgage this way. But eventually it is likely to cause a general global default on its debts. Every country in the world will say, hey, we're not going to pay our debts either. We'll just kind of right away, the global debt will go from whatever it is now to zero. Well, what does this do to all the financial institutions? There may not be any. If the dollar crashes, what does that do to this country? How do you pay taxes if the money is worthless? If you're not making an income, one thing that would happen, I suppose, is that if your wages do keep up with inflation, you are getting pushed into higher and higher tax brackets all the time. But because we've had pro-business administrations in Washington for years, there really are no higher tax brackets anyway. So that is sort of what we have in store, and that is what could follow from if my prediction comes out that if the oil bores in Iran continues. Well, we're getting near the end of our time. I got to say something about this big battle over cartoons depicting Muhammad. I mean, I don't know if anybody really know what Prophet Muhammad looked like. I mean, if somebody draws a picture and says, this is Muhammad, how do you know? It might not be at all. But if you say so, I guess that's good enough for some people, or bad enough for some people. One thing this shows, besides the volatility in the Islamic world, is that Danes and Norwegians can be just as stupid as anybody else. The Danes and Norwegians have this kind of reputation for being pretty cool-headed, rational, and competent people. But it looks like maybe they are not. this newspaper, that this Danish paper that first published these cartoons, the Jyllands Posten, 3 years ago, they turned down a cartoon because they thought it might offend Christians. So, but they went ahead with these cartoons that greatly offended the Muslims of the world. Also, we have the European nations and the media, you know, talking about their love for free speech. But most of these European countries have been jailing Holocaust deniers for quite some time. In fact, the historian, so-called historian David Ehring, I believe, is in an Austrian prison. So, I mean, if to me, denying the Holocaust is just an idiotic thing to say. It's just totally untrue. But you shouldn't jail people for being idiots and fools. But anyway, the the European nations are doing that. So anyway, that is the end of this segment. This has been sort of a report on the empire and its downward trajectory. And so stay tuned, because I see Andrew Geller in the air room. I think he has got something good for us coming up.